Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone. We have host today, Lawrence Drink, also known as Spocky Lee, is going to be having his guest on with him today, and he will be hosting Shedding Light. They will be discussing some of the issues that are going on in the prisons and on the outside as well. And they will be talking about the success stories of prisoners who rehabilitated themselves. So let's welcome the host, Lawrence Drink. Are you on, Lawrence?
I'm here. How y'all doing? Can you hear me? Leona?
Yes, I was on mute. I'm sorry. I said I was going to be. Everyone can hear you, Lawrence.
Oh, well, so welcome, everybody. My name is Lawrence Drink, a.k.a. Sparky Lee, and I am the CEO and founding director of Legacy Programs Education Reentry. We serve the needs of the community as well as the families and the offenders. We offer mentoring programs. We believe that reentry begins when you go in, not when you just get out, and therefore we offer curriculum for anyone that's already in, so it's a year program. And it's just been something that's been in my heart since before I even got out 13 years ago, where I wanted to develop something and then for the incarcerated. And then when I got out, I realized that there was so much stuff that needed to be done for reentry and things that were missing. So we kind of added to the program as far as more curriculum. We offered the mentoring program, the crisis hotline, and stuff like that. And you could find any of our services or sign up for your loved ones on legacyprograms.net. We also do cards for the incarcerated. So if you have a loved one that wants to get a letter or a card to let them know that the community is there for them and loves them, feel free to sign them up. And we should have a special guest. Anthony should be on today. I don't know if, can you check Leona if he's on? And then we also have my little brother Tommy and my sister-in-law, also the secretary of Legacy Programs. She's on as well. So, and then Christine, you got anything to say?
No, not at the moment, no.
Okay.
We have Brady and we have Christine. Anthony is not on as yet.
Okay, so this is just the thing that I've been going through. Is I realized the other day that reentry is so more dimensional than just one. And in order to successfully, I believe in abolishing the prison system, but I also see that how we're doing it is not, the laws aren't going to take into effect anytime soon. It's such a broken system, and it's going to take that much longer to fix that. We focus our goal on keeping everybody out and keeping those beds vacant. And so that's just been my goal of trying to get back at the system to make sure that, you know, what I went through doesn't have to happen to somebody else. And like I said, if everyone knows what I've gone through is, I was released homeless, no resources. All the programs out here that was meant for us, they did absolutely nothing for me because they were being ran by the sheriff's department, which anyone in my area knows that I've been in the system since 9 years old, an active gang member, and they didn't want to do anything for me. So when the sheriff's department was doing the screening process, they were like, no, we're not accepting them. He'd go somewhere else. So four programs that were meant that get the funding every year, big money, millions, they turned their back on me because of who was doing the screening process. So that was another reason why I wanted to offer something, and that we wanted to make sure that everything was, all needs were met, and that we weren't going to sit there and, you know, try to tell who can join and who can't join the program. So, we accept everybody. There's no judgment here as far as who we serve. I don't believe that in advocacy we don't get to pick and choose who we help and who we don't. We're either all in or all out. And then, like I said, our guests should be coming on. I offered, and if anybody wants their voice to be heard and to get what they're doing out there, I believe that there's a lot of advocates out here doing what they're supposed to do, but I also believe that there's more not doing what they're supposed to do. I think that I could see how the money can kind of go to their heads and they forget their mission statement. So, as I always say, you know, for the advocates doing what you're supposed to, we all appreciate it. And for the ones that are not, I'm sorry to hear that. So, this is just something that I've been working on myself as far as, being out here, and I've only been out 6 months. So, and I've organized the legacy programs and, we're all over Facebook and stuff. So it actually worked out. But anybody on Leona? Still waiting.
But you know what? I just got a message from Jeffrey. Deskovit is going to be coming on as well to join you. Let's see.
Okay, good.
He
was supposed to be on, I think, this week as well. So he's actually an interesting story. You know, he was bringing up a lot of facts about how many people are falsely convicted every year, and it's crazy how they're really quick to make somebody plead out or to convict them on a trial. But what happens is that when it's time to let them go and to realize that they're innocent or that that facts were wrong and they were harshly pursued, they take forever to fix this thing. I mean, they don't just let somebody out because they're innocent. And I think that's very disturbing to me, and it should be disturbing to a lot of the taxpayers because, you know, these are the people that are footing the bill. So I don't understand how they get away with this, but they do. And then the mistreatment that they have in the system is, I don't understand how nobody's asking more questions. That's just my take on things.
That's the problem. So, I find that a problem all the time because people don't ask questions, and I always encourage it. We have a 914 on the line with us. Please state your name.
Hi, this is Jeff Deskovic.
Jeff, what's up, brother? How you doing?
Hey, how you doing, Lawrence?
Not bad, brother. I'm free. I'm a rich man. I got shelter, food, clothes, and God. I'm good.
There we go. Listen, if you have those things, lots of possibilities. If you don't have that, you don't have your health, then you have nothing. Then there are no possibilities, right?
Yeah, absolutely. So how you doing?
I'm very good, thank you. Very good. Like you said, I'm free above and therefore lots of possibilities.
Yeah. So can you go into a little bit more for the people that missed last week? Like what do you do?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So I'm an attorney and I help free people who are wrongfully imprisoned, and I push policy changes that are aimed at preventing wrongful conviction in the first place. And I also fight for broader criminal justice reform. And in a nutshell, I got into doing this advocacy work, which I've been doing for about 14 years now, because I spent 16 years in prison myself from age 17 to 32 prior to being proven innocent through DNA testing.
Nice. And what do you, how do you feel like the events of the prison, the conditioning and everything else, how do you think that's affected you today?
Well, I had to overcome a lot of habits. I mean, for one thing, you know, there's not a lot of stimulus in prison. You know, there's a limited number of choices. There's a very limited number of decisions that you can make. And out here in the world, you know, there's a lot of different choices. I mean, for example, if you go to a restaurant, there's a lot of things on the mess hall, a lot of things on the menu. It's not like you go to the mess hall and it's just one thing, and either you eat it or you don't. When you go to the store, there's a wide variety of brands and different prices and quality. It's not like going to commissary, where it's just one item and it's the price that it is, and there's not really a choice of the different brands. So I think just getting used to having choices, and then even the idea of not having to ask for permission. I mean, I remember when I originally was released, I really wasn't sure of what was allowed and what wasn't allowed, and what are the norms and mores and rules and regulations. You know, so there definitely was that aspect to it, and I had to reframe my thinking, and, you know, I purposely broke prison habits. I mean, such as, you know, I used to go to restaurants initially, and I would pick the seat that has my back to the wall, and that's, you know, it's a remnant from being incarcerated, where if something happens, you put your back to the wall, and you keep everything in front of you where you can see it. So, you know, there was that, and I forced myself to stop using the prison lingo just to further get out of that frame of thinking. So all of those things, and even just trying to catch up on technology. I mean, they don't give cell phones, there's no GPS, and even the computer programs are not similar to Windows or a Mac if you're using that. So
yeah.
All those different aspects, you know, have impact. And believe it or not, even right now, 14 years out, sometimes it feels unusual for me to be walking around with keys and, you know, have a car and I'm allowed to move around without anybody, you know, being aware necessarily of where I'm going or what time I'm going to arrive there. There's no pad
yeah.
to monitor.
No, I mean, I go through the same thing. I went to a restaurant last night and just ordering food and sitting there, and I always feel like there's a sign above me saying I just got out of prison. And it's just, it's crazy. About just 2 weeks ago, 2.5 weeks, I got the feeling of where I didn't want to go back to prison. It was, and I've been out 6 months. So it took that long just for my mind to develop saying, you know what? Because every time something went wrong, I'd be like, I'll just go back to prison. You know, I'll just go back, and it'll be easier. Because it's stressful out here, man. When stuff starts breaking down and you got to pay bills and you got to be, especially, you know, like right now I'm going through the whole job thing. Nobody wants to hire me. So it's one of those things of you feeling less adequate, you know, your self-esteem gets attacked, stuff like that. But, no, I get it. And walking around with keys is a big deal for me. It's actually a freedom about it, just carrying around keys. But what do you think, since you did so much time in the prison system as well as I did, what do you think the long-term effects, like, do you think that mass incarceration is actually helping or hurting more of us coming out?
So the question is if I think mass incarceration is hurting people who come out.
I think
that it's hurting because a lot of people are returned back to prison on technical parole violations. And, you know, we know that if there are more people incarcerated, then there's, you know, there's bodies to fill up the beds. And, you know, that's linked to correction officer jobs. And that, you know, that also shows the need for, you know, for parole officers. You know, more people to have oversight on and see, we got to watch these guys. We can't just let them out. And that's it, you know, women too. So I think, plus the whole mind frame. I mean, I just want to break down technical parole violation for anyone listening. So what I mean by that is while I was in prison, I saw people come back in for minor things, like not crimes or not even like violations of the terms of their parole conditions, but silly things like you're supposed to be inside at 8 o'clock and you actually got there at 8:05 or 8:10, or you didn't notify the parole officer of a change of address, and people would come back to prison for a year or 2 years for silly things like that. And while I don't advocate for just people being able to do what they want to do, I do think that responses should be appropriate, not going too far, not overdoing it. And I think that that's all excessive. So I think that mass incarceration affects people that are coming back out to the world in that way. And I think it adds the overall culture and perception like that, incarceration is the answer to everything. And generally speaking, I think that that breeds a viewpoint of suspicion and over scrutiny, and that can lead to difficulty in obtaining jobs and renting apartments to people who were formerly incarcerated, and even I think in terms of social ties as well, forming social relationships. So
that's funny you say that about the parole violations, because they add that to our recidivism quote when they say that so many inmates return from were formerly incarcerated, that you're right. It does go to, how many of them are actually committing new crimes? That's a stat that they need to go off of, not violations, because violations are very minute. Like you say, curfew, we're not even talking about a drug test, but just a curfew, a knife in the living room,
Yeah, I think Leona was trying to say something. Yeah.
Oh, sorry.
No, Jeff, I was actually going to question, when you're inside of the prisons, would it be more beneficial that they have like a type of testing where they don't just stick you all in one category of people, but more or less you're like an altitude test where, you score a certain, average on the test, and then they place you in a mod or a pod or a cell with the minutiae of the people that basically have the same intellectuality as yourself? Or do they just stick?
I don't think I'd want to do, I understand what you're saying. I agree with the spirit of what you're saying. I don't think I would want to categorize it in terms of intellect, but intellectual capacity. I would separate people this way if it was up to me. And I wrote about this in an article that was published by Goodman Project, my top 10 ideas on prison reform. And one of them would be, I would separate kids from adults. And while that sounds like it shouldn't need to be said, if you're charged with as an adult, if a child is charged as an adult, which a lot of states allow, 16, 17-year-olds federally, you can even charge at 13. So I think that age should be separated from the rest of the prison population. Maybe the cutoff would be maybe 23 or 24 or 25, something like that. But right now there's a general mixing. So I would separate that way. I would also segregate prisoners who are determined to be vulnerable, who have mental health issues or who could likely to be abused by the other prisoners. So I think they should be kept away from the rest of the population, so they're not mistreated. Same thing with people who are incarcerated for sex offenses. This is a vigilante mentality towards people who have been convicted of sex offenses. I would further break down people who are incarcerated for nonviolent offenses. I don't think should be incarcerated with prisoners who are there for violent offenses. I don't think that people who are there for violent offenses, I think that could be a further breakdown. There's a percentage of the population and the way that they carry themselves, although they're incarcerated for a violent crime, they're not conducting themselves violently as prisoners, whereas there's some prisoners who incarcerated for violent crimes and they're just basically running wild, running amok and continuing criminal behavior while incarcerated. So I think that there should be a further breakdown of that, because it is possible that you could could very easily find yourself as a prisoner in a position where you have to defend yourself, i.e. engage in one kind of violent act or another in order to protect yourself. And all that could be avoided if we can just separate out
so
that way.
So they do have something similar. It's called a classification score. And when you go in, if you're not married, I went in at 18 years old, and I had no military, no job background. So I had an on-max score of like 100, and plus I was a former YA commitment. So when I went in, I went to a level 4 180 because they deemed me violent. They stuck me in a cell with a four life sentence. He had four life sentences, and they weren't supposed to. He outweighed me by probably 75 pounds. He was – so they have this thing where when you go in, you're classified. They see your score. They see your term, your everything. What happens is they're not supposed to sell you up with anyone that outweighs you by 50 pounds. They're not supposed to sell you up with anyone out of your age category. It's supposed to be within your own age. And this is to further protect us. They also have a thing where they do separate us. It's called the EOP program, or EOP, and they have for mental health, it's triple DMS or something. I forget what it's called, DDP. So what happens is they're supposed to separate everybody, but they don't. And like you say, you know, when the violence is usually in the higher levels, the level ones are usually the nonviolent offenders, because you can't get into a fire camp or anything without being violent or with being violent. And you have to have so much time on your sentence, like within a year of release or something like that. So they have all this stuff in place. They're just not implementing it. They're putting lifers.
You did your time federally or in a state? In state.
I did my time in state.
Okay, well, I'm saying I think that varies from state to state. Like I did the 16 years I did in New York, and you know I've never heard of those terms. I don't believe they have that system in place in New York. So I think that it's state to state.
Okay, well, I mean the thing is that CDC in California does not go by any of their guidelines that they're supposed to. The federal guidelines that they had, they even had federal guidelines for COVID, and they refused to follow them, refused the masks, refused the testing, but yet the inmates have to get tested. So it's like the state to state, like you say, they do whatever they want. You know, the union is so powerful. It's under the same, I believe the California is under the sheriff's or CHP's union. And they're just as powerful, if not more. They determined Arnold Schwarzenegger's election and his recall. So it's crazy how these unions are so powerful, and they're dictating what's going on in those prisons, and they have no idea of what's going on. They're not for our rehabilitation; they're for our recidivism, and they put things in. I mean, you know about that. You know that they don't help us while we're in.
No, they definitely don't. No, and I want to add that, you know, the correction officer union, like in New York, for example, and this is where, you know, the danger of mixing economic well-being, relying that on prison and incarceration gets dangerous. So there was a movement in New York to reform the Rockefeller drug laws, which were laws that allowed the state to impose terms of imprisonment like 15, 20, 25, 30 years on prisoners who defendants who are found guilty of possessing a small amount of drugs, small quantity of drugs. So there were people inside with those type of sentences who were sentenced to even more time than prisoners who were there for violent offenses or even killing somebody. But when there was a movement during the years that the movement to reform the drug laws were being made, the correction officer union was opposing the reforming of those sentencing laws. You know, and it was widely understood that the rationale of why they were doing that is because they knew that more people would be going home, and the ones who would be coming in would be coming in for less time, and that was ultimately going to equal less correction officer jobs and maybe even the closing of some facilities. They didn't want that.
Yeah. Right now, California's going through that. They're closing down these old prisons that should have been slammed down a whole long time ago. It's just crazy how a business out here can run or get shut down for being underran, but yet the prisons, they could have these prisons since the 70s and the 60s and sit there and do this to, you know, where, and they're up and running just fine. It's ridiculous. But so what are you like, so how long did it take you to transition out here? You don't mind me asking.
I definitely don't mind you asking. I'm very open and comfortable. It took me a really long time. I'm at the best I ever have been now. I mean, 14 years home, but in certain ways, I mean, I still feel like I'm still readjusting. I might say I'm more readjusted now than what I was even a year ago. I think it really started to take effect maybe like after like 6 or 7 years. But even now, I mean, I still feel a little bit of the after effects of my experience. Like, it still feels weird to me here every now and then. The things we talk about.
What about smells? Do you have familiar smells that you come across that just put you back in the X spot or the, you know, uncomfortable feeling?
No,
or
not any smells. But what I do have, which is kind of similar to what you're asking me, is I don't like loud noises. If I hear an unexpected loud noise, that startles me, and I get on alert right away, and I'm looking around. I want to know what happened, and it takes me a few minutes to calm down, even after I realize what actually the noise is and, you know, what it was, and that it has nothing to do with the violent incident transpiring. It still takes a couple of minutes to, you know, just breathe and relax. So
sounds almost like PTSD.
Well, it is. That's a common after effect of being wrongfully incarcerated. PTSD and related symptoms like panic attacks, anxiety, feeling of processing things at a slower speed, feeling of having been frozen in time. Like, when I was initially released, I was 32, but I felt like I was 17 because that was the age that I last was free. Like, even now, I feel like I'm maybe like 27, 28 years old, even though physically I'm 47.
Yeah.
It's not really like a full of energy, I found the fountain of youth, yay, type of thing. This is more like more of a disconnect where the, you know, the emotional, mental, and psychological, there's a disconnect between that and the physical age.
Yeah. I go through the same thing, like handling conflicts, emotions, when I'm dealing with people. I have a way of disconnecting that makes me, and then, like, even time management. How bad was your time management at first?
Yeah, at first it was not good. I didn't like to have too many things going on, even if it's, you know, at different times in the same day. You know, and I feel like even now I don't do well if things are chaotic. Like, if I have everything organized and well scheduled, that's one thing. But if I feel like too many things are going on at the same time, or, you know, there's a lot of energy in the air, you know, I get a little bit nervous. I think that, you know, there's one glitch or one thing or another is going to happen, and it's going to speedball from one minor thing and culminate into something big. I did have a hard time prioritizing. Like, when you're trying to reintegrate and rebuild your life, and, you know, there's an urge to try to get as much done as you can at once, because you want to try to, like, norm out your life to be even with other people who haven't been incarcerated. And there's so many things to do to get as many things set up as you can. And after a while, it became hard for me to even figure out, like, which of this mile-long list of things to do, what should I do next? And sometimes I couldn't decide, and so my mind just felt overloaded. And at that point,
yeah.
I would just have to lay down and go to sleep and hope that I woke up with a better mind.
I do the same thing. I go through it, I think, weekly. There's always something that triggers. I get overwhelmed, and I just get immediately tired, and I just have to just relax, you know, just and then hopefully it just regroup later on. Hey, Leona, is anybody else on? Any phone calls?
No, 914-626-6206 and 805.
And that's one of the things I think that people don't – a lot of the people I hear don't understand what I go through is that, like, there's a complete disconnect going on because I'm already alienated, you know. Like you say, I feel like I'm 16, 17, I'm 39 years old, and, you know, like the time management. I think the other day I had issues with – you know, because I like to play video games every once in a while. I like to, you know, talk to people. And when, you know, these are all things that normal kids go through, you know. And then I get out here, I'm 39 years old, and I don't have a bedtime. I don't have lights out. I don't have chow to go to. So, like, there's things as simple as I forget to eat sometimes, and where I look in the refrigerator and I have all this food, and yet I can't decide on anything, and I sit there with the refrigerator open for 10 minutes trying to figure out what I want to eat, you know. So it's just I'm just glad to hear other people that I'm not so alone, and that, you know, there's other people going through the same thing. So, and like you say, the catch-up, you know, trying to be successful. I'm trying to do in 1 year what people do in 10 years. And I think that sometimes that pushes people off. It, you know, gets people where they get the perception that I'm unrealistic, that I'm pushy, that I'm persistent, you know. So I'm just glad to see what you're doing and what you've done. And, you know, I'm hoping to work with you later on. So.
Yeah, definitely. I like collaborating and, you know, working together and get a lot more done that way than individually. But when you were mentioning trying to get everything done in like a year, what could normally be done in 10, you know, I kind of laughed to myself because there was actually a news article that came out like shortly after, maybe like a year after I'd been home. It was like a newspaper article, kind of like in the "Where Are They Now" type of spirit. And the title of the article, and this was by the Journal News, it was called the title of it was called "A Year to make up 16 years." So huh. I know what you mean. So yeah, there definitely are a lot of similar characteristics when it comes to reentry. I know that the more that I learn and understand technology, the more tied into the world that I feel, and the more that translates into the more normal it feels, more normal I feel, and the more normal it feels to be out here in the world.
Yeah.
So,
What you say is when we get overwhelmed, I was doing something with, I was doing job resumes on or something online for a job, and it was so difficult to understand. So I called the people and I said, "Hey, can you make this more tech friendly for people like me? Because they're supposed to help the formerly incarcerated find jobs. It's for us. It's, I forget the program, what it's called, but I contacted the owner and I said, the creator founder. And I said, "Hey, this needs to be more tech friendly. Like, you're asking for a resume. I don't know how to do a resume online. Cause it's talking about PDF and everything else. And you got to convert it. And like, there's so much stuff to it. And these aren't the things that we learn in prison. I mean, they're still teaching a checkbook balance and a paper resume. I mean, in my opinion, in my experience out here, I have not filled out one paper resume. Everything's online. So, and we're so far behind. My 12-year-old could teach me how to use a phone. You know, I talk to my sister-in-law or my brother or my wife or, you know, somebody around me to help me. But I mean, I already have this thing where I don't like asking for help. You know, I'll just figure it out on my own. But then in the meantime, I get overwhelmed, and I disconnect myself and I take a step back trying to figure it out. And it's just in doing so, I like kind of emotionally just shut off, you know, like we're okay. I'm not stressed out. It's just it's one of them things, you know. I mean, I'm sure you went through the same thing, right?
I absolutely went through the same thing, yes. And what I want to mention to you is, you know, there is a product out there which is called Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game, which I co-own, and it is designed to facilitate formerly incarcerated people with reconnecting with their friends and family through icebreaker type of questions, because you know, I found that it was hard for me to communicate with people who had not been incarcerated, were not familiar with, you know, what I had been through or even what I'm experiencing in the moment in trying to reintegrate into society. And on their end, you know, like my brother told me before, he said, I'm not sure of what to ask, what to say, what not to say, what not to ask. You know, so Recharge kind of steps in the middle of that and removes the awkwardness through posing these icebreaker questions that get people talking, but in a very comfortable, organic type of way.
Yeah, and so I have another question for you, but I don't know if it's too personal, but
no,
I'm gonna
feel
ask.
I'm very transparent. Please feel free to ask whatever you'd like.
Okay, going through the system, how was it going through the system? Because we have this thing where sex offenders get beat up, they get killed, you know, this whole thing. Can you walk me through how it was being falsely accused of a sex crime in a federal prison?
I can in a state prison. Remember, I did my time in New York State, not a federal facility. But I get your question,
state, yeah.
Though, and I will walk you through it. Yeah. Yeah, so what it meant for me is that, so first of all, I was never able to fully relax. I mean, you know, not that there's a lot of relaxing you could do in a prison anyway, but it was always on the back of my mind, you know. And if people would discover what, you know, I was incarcerated for, then, you know, that could be motivation on their part to, you know, assault me. I mean, so there were times in the course of my incarceration I was beat up. One time I nearly lost my life. I got hit on repeatedly on both sides of my head with a 10-pound weight plate. So there was that. So it also led to a lot of awkward conversations, and, you know, people would ask, you know, what are you in for? And, you know, I would just, because I was there for murder and rape. And so I would, in the prison lingo, I would just say, you know, I have a body, which is just a, you know, slang for I have a murder case. And I would leave out the other aspect of that. But yeah, it was, you know, the reason why I made a trip to solitary, I made one trip for solitary confinement, you know, for 28 days, because I was defending myself preemptively against people that were going to come to stab me up because they thought that I was a rapist. So, and then, you know, again, I saw other people be mistreated, and that ranged from verbally to physical, you know, just getting beat up. Sometimes people were cut or stabbed. It wasn't limited to the prisoners. So sometimes the correctional staff would also, like I heard from, you know, sometimes the correctional staff would say abusive things to me verbally. And there were a few times when I received word that, you know, that correction officers were telling other people about, you know, what the charges were, you know, and it was, you know, clear that the purpose of them doing that was they were hoping that somebody would decide to, you know, would decide to try to attack me. So, I mean, that was like, and then New York State has what's called conjugal visits. So there's a trailer located. There's some trailers located on the prison ground. So if someone's married, you could get a visit with your wife, for example. She could show up on a Friday, and then she would stay with you, you know, all of Friday and Friday night, Saturday night, and, you know, then leave Sunday morning. But you could also get what they call the family trailer. So it could just be that, you know, your mother or brother or sister or somebody came up. But, you know, because I was incarcerated for a sex offense, you know, they weren't willing to let me participate in that program unless I took and completed the sex offender training program, which had a guilt admission requirement tied to it. Everybody in the program would be expected to admit guilt to the instructor and to the other prisoners. Simply saying you were guilty wouldn't cut it. They wanted a blow-by-blow account, and the verbal rendition was not sufficient. They wanted everything in writing, and refusal to complete any aspect of that would result in immediate removal from the program, with the prisoner being deemed to have refused to complete the program. So the correctional officials, they tried every which way to force me to take the program. I mean, from refusing to allow me to participate in a family reunion program to, you know, I was supposed to be transferred to lower security level. So I was in New York State. If you're 7 years close to the parole board, then you're supposed to be transferred to a medium unless you're considered to be an escape risk. So even though that's the general rule, they refused to drop my security level because I would not take and complete the program. They refused to put me in for a transfer to a facility closer to home. They kept me in Elmira, which was four and a half hours away. They refused to transfer me closer to home because I refused to take the sex offender program. They told me when I took the program, then, you know, I could get transferred closer. I could be submitted for consideration to be transferred closer to home. And similarly, although it might sound silly for people to hear, the prison did have what they called an, you know, honor block. And so they had certain minor creature comforts there. So you could go to recreation every night there rather than every day. You could shower daily, either in the afternoon or at night. You could go to commissary, which is the way of going to the store. You could go to the store every week rather than twice a month. And they even had gallery recreation, so you didn't have to go out to the recreational area. You could go to a day room, and, you know, they had, movie TV, and they, you know, they had a stove there. They had a refrigerator there. You could purchase oil and flour. So they had all these different creature comforts, which, again, might sound silly to people out here, but was a really big thing inside there. But, again, because I refused to take and complete the sex offender training program, I was removed from the waiting list for that program and was not allowed to get back on it. So that aspect of what the correctional authorities was another aspect of being in prison, as being falsely accused and convicted of a sex crime, as opposed to if I had not in fact been charged with a sex offense.
And that's what I don't get. Like, how is an honor, you're telling me an honor building or an honor yard is a simple necessity that we have out here, a shower more than once a day, or a shower more than three times a week. You got, because what I just heard was you could buy extra food so you could eat. You could have daylight. You could go out to a rec daily.
A
stove to cook your food. Like, these are things that every inmate should have anyways. This shouldn't be an honor thing, and that's how they dehumanize us, by taking these necessities and these common comforts that, you know, like you say, you know, when you have to say, hey, I know this sounds silly, but it doesn't to me. And I know it sounds silly to some people, but this is how ridiculous the system is and how they're getting away with dehumanizing us. I mean, that's stupid. And I mean,
to have more air, to have more recreational opportunities, to be able to cook food, to be able to shower more frequently in order to be able to go shopping more than twice a month. Yeah. I mean, these are the, you know, these are some, you know, certain basics that are, you know, that they kind of weaponized, in the prison. No.
Oh, this is me.
Honestly, there were so many times. There were times, and again, this might sound silly or maybe not. I don't know. I mean, I have a feeling nothing I say is going to sound silly to you. But then again, you've been incarcerated, and so for people who have not been, that don't have really a context. I mean, it's one thing to be working in the field. And so a lot of these things wouldn't sound silly to someone listening, even if they had not been incarcerated just from working in the field. But somebody that's not even like tangentially connected, these things might might sound silly, but there were times when I was incarcerated that I felt, you know, where I was feeling just particularly dejected. And I thought, man, you know, like, damn, man, I really wish I could be locked up here for something other than a sex offense. I mean, why
yeah.
why does that have to be one of the charges, and I have to deal with all this other extra stuff, and, you know, be in fear of my life, you know, daily, and having to constantly worry if people were, you know, would find out what I was incarcerated for, and, you know, and then have to deal with whatever ramifications that would be. I remember one time when I was in Shawangunk, which was a Maxi Max, and it was a small prison, and it was close to the city, so everyone was on top of each other, you know, meaning it was a small facility, and everyone was knee-deep into each other's business, and very little happened there, which it was a good thing, but then it also, it caused the prisoners there to have an over sense of confidence. Everybody thought they could say and do whatever they wanted to somebody else, and so, and with no consequences, so that ultimately translated into a lot less respect. And so prisoners went to the law library. They got nosy about what I was incarcerated for, and they went to the law library and they looked my case up, because when you have an appeal, their decisions come out in the law books, and the law books are in the prison law library, you know, and when decisions come out, those cases and decisions can be used when furthering someone else's argument. So they found my case, and they made copies of it, and they brought it back to the unit where I was, you know, where I was in, you know, the cell block that I was in, and they were passing them out to people, stapling it up on the board, and the whole environment got hostile against me. And the few that were not, the majority of them, you know, said, "Look, man, I don't want to talk with you. I don't want to have anything really to do with you. This is what's going on. I don't take part in that. I don't condone that. But at the same time, you know, I don't want no problems. You know, I got to stay away from you, man. You know, so just trying to, you know, I had that environment, and, you know, it ultimately translated into the hostility that I referenced earlier with the whole wait situation.
Yeah. Hey, what? Now, this is another personal question, but what stopped you from killing yourself?
Because
I'm sure
was
many
afraid.
People are asking that.
Yeah. Yes, of course, because I was afraid that even that would go wrong for me. And so I'd still be wrongfully imprisoned. The only thing is my situation would be worse. You know, I might my neck might be broken, or I might be into a wheelchair, or, you know, if I try to collect pills and overdose, which is another method that people use to kill themselves while in prison, you know, maybe my kidneys don't work anymore. Now I'm stuck into a dialysis machine. So that was the big thing. I mean, there are other factors as to how I got through my experience. I mean, certainly belief in God and learning the law gave a sense of comfort, and reading about articles of other people who were exonerated gave me inspiration, and developed a routine. And there were another prisoner there who was innocent, who was exonerated a couple of years after me, but we kept each other going for 13 and a half years, and then a pen pal showed up right in the nick of time the last year or two. I mean, I was openly asking him in a letter, look, should I just give up? Should I just commit suicide and be done? And this was a stranger that I had no relationship, no pre-existing relationship. He simply responded to an ad I placed in the newspaper. So all of those things, and, you know, elaborate delusion when I would play chess or play basketball or play chess, I would pretend like I was a professional player, and so were the others. But it wasn't like kids fantasizing on a screen lot. I mean, a playground. It was more like I needed to escape the prison for a couple of hours. And I cut out nature scenes, and I would hang those pictures up on the cell wall so that I could just travel there mentally, because that was about the most I was going to be able to do. So all of those things were factors. And, you know, the euphemisms, it's not the warden, it's the prison superintendent. And I'm not going to my prison job in the morning or in the afternoon, but I'm quote unquote going to work, or I'm going, you know, to school.
Yeah. So, and I was just going to ask that, like, what was, I asked you what kept you from killing yourself, but what was, if there's anything extra, like what kept you going? Like what was in the front of your mind, like, I'm going to do this.
Well,
there's
so
no
I
way.
I was thinking about the next appeal, and I was thinking that I was going to win. I thought I was going to win the next appeal. And so, I thought I was going to win the next appeal. So I thought I just had to hold on for like a year or two till the next appeal was going to be decided, which I was sure that I was going to win because I was innocent. And I was innocent. And I still believed in the court system at that point.
Nice. And then what were your relationships like through this time of incarceration?
You mean with people I knew from the street that were on
with
the,
your
that
family,
on.
Yeah, with your family, the outside. Like, did you lose everybody like most people do, or did you hang on to them? Or
yeah, no, I lost touch with the. I lost. So, well, really, when I got arrested, I lost all my friends at that point. I mean, I became a hated figure in Peekskill where everything happened at, and. You know, everyone thought I was guilty, and the few that did not, their parents wouldn't allow them to play with me any longer, have anything to do with me. In prison, I mean, I had two friends that came to see me. One person only came one time, and that was it. Another person stayed in touch with me for 5 years, but then, you know, he went to the military, and that was the end of that. My mother was my only consistent visitor. She used to come with my grandmother, but my grandmother passed away 6 years into my incarceration. The last 5 or 6 years, my mother used to come see me like once every 6 months. My brother is 3.5 years younger than me, and he came to see me 3 times in 16 years, not at all in the last decade. I had a couple of sets of aunts and uncles. And they would come and then disappear for 3 years, come and disappear for 3 years. So in a lot of ways, you know, in many ways, though not literally, I mean, I mainly did the time by myself.
Yeah. No, I can see. Yeah, no, most people in general for any type of crime do their time by themselves. Were you bitter?
When I came home or in while I was still inside.
Both, especially
well,
afterwards.
I was bitter on the outside the first week I was home, but then I realized, look, this is destroying me. I have to let go of this. So, I mean, I figured that I felt, look, it was destroying me. A second thing was, you know, I wanted to enjoy. I couldn't do that while being angry or bitter. Another thing was I felt like I lost so much. Why would I want to, in effect, lose the rest of my life? If I was to be angry or bitter, then it's not like I would be adversely affecting anybody else. I would be the only loser in that scenario. So for all those lines of reasoning, you know, I let go of the anger, and it's really worked out. In terms of when I was in prison, at times I was angry. I mean, I was even angry with God, but, you know, at times. But overall, though, I mean, I really wasn't angry while I was in. I mean, it was more like I was doing everything I could to just survive mentally, physically. Then at times I couldn't really believe that I really was, that everything my senses were telling me was true, that I was, in fact, incarcerated, you know, for a crime that I didn't, you know, commit. So, I mean, there was that aspect to it. But then also, you know, in order to survive, you try to get yourself into some kind of mental routine or mental niche. And so I kind of lived within that niche some also. You find little minor things that you like to do to try to make things a little bit more tolerable. So from 1998 forward to 2006, I mean, I read 3 or 4 nonfiction books a week. And, you know, I became an avid chess player and had a little mini chess library, and you know, I used to play basketball, and I listened to sports radio, and I loved when it was football season because I would just kind of overdose on football games on Sundays. I'd listen to the 1 o'clock game, the 4 o'clock game, the Sunday night football, Monday night. It was crazy because I had the radio, but the team I wanted to listen to was only on the radio. That wasn't the game that was carried by the market. So I would be watching one game on television while listening to another game on the radio. So, I mean, all those different things. I mean, heck, I even, on Thursday nights when I was in the cell, I mean, I used to watch wrestling, and, you know, that was, you could hear a lot of people doing that and laughing and, you know, laughing at the different skits and storylines and everything else.
What's your favorite team?
Yeah, my favorite team is was the New York Giants. But I also was a big Buffalo. I was a Giants fan. I liked the Buffalo Bills also, but as compared to the two, I would definitely cheer for the, you know, Giants over the Bills.
Okay. No, I asked that because I think one of the things I enjoy being asked out here are simple questions like, what's my favorite color? It's almost like I'm being humanized again, you know, like somebody actually cares about what my favorite color is or favorite football team. So, no, I just asked that because I can only imagine what you went through and how you were just dehumanized. That's I know that word's being thrown around a lot, but that's what it is. I mean, you get in a routine.
You're just wearing a number. Prison. They even give you a number. You have to memorize the number. You have to memorize the prison number and regurgitate that on demand on a moment's notice. So my number was 91A0763.
Yeah, mine was T57463. And it's funny because people call me, I went by prison handles. You know, I had the name Breeze for years. And all of a sudden now people are like, hey, Lawrence. And sometimes I still have to, I won't even turn around and acknowledge them because it's so weird to hear my original name that I was given my birth name and to be able to acknowledge that part of me, you know, because I think I kind of put it under a facade because in prison I was not a nice guy. You know, I had a lot of violence and stuff like that. But the violence that I did in prison was to hide my self-image, like who I was. And I just recreated myself into this like a mobster almost, you know, and it just it wasn't beneficial when I got out.
Can I say something about the prison system, the injustice that goes on in the prisons? And I'm speaking from personal experience with a loved one. One of the things is when someone commits a crime, a first offense, say firing one shot 28, 30 years ago, and they get a life without, they've never been involved with drugs or alcohol, they've never been in trouble with the law, they go to prison. And because of connections, they're denied everything. They try to take higher educational correspondence courses. They try to get jobs in the prison. They try to do everything, and they're deprived and denied everything. So they file a lawsuit against the prison for the civil right violation because even medical problems, they don't get treated right away until 2 years later. So what happens is they file a lawsuit. They can't get a lawyer. They file a lawsuit. And they end up, after several months into the lawsuit, they end up getting put in the hole. The prison officials file a motion to have his case dismissed. And after it's dismissed, they let him out of the hole. He plans to file an appeal when suddenly we have a pandemic. And then they're put in their cells 22 hours a day. So another thing is when they did finally do the surgery on the knee, they removed the cartilage from the knee. He had a problem with the shoulder. A year and a half later, they operated, and they removed the cartilage from the shoulder. But not only the cartilage, they removed part of his collarbone. They kept him in the cell 22 hours a day. After the surgery, his shoulder now is permanently damaged because the correctional surgeon removed his cartilage and also part of his collarbone, when in fact, and I have the MRI, had nothing to do with the collarbone. But because he had filed this lawsuit, this is their way of punishing him, putting him on a block that he should not be on, a restrictive block, and no lawyers, no lawyer, no advocate have been willing to help him. Now, this is a person that has severe depression because now he cannot protect himself. He was a four-year biology major. He knew right out that cartilage did not have to be removed. He knew that collarbone did not have to be cut, and still it didn't. This is a correctional surgeon. In doing the research, we found that this was not the first case. There has been four or five other lawsuits, and the same thing happened, permanent damages. But these people get away with it because they're corrections, and these people are prisoners. It doesn't make sense, but this is what's happened. We have a high rate of suicide in this country, and we have a high rate of suicide right here in Massachusetts. But yet these people are driven to become so depressed. And this particular individual went to prison for a life without parole for a first-time offense committed while he was severely depressed, and it was brought up in court. These are some of the issues of injustice that I really despise, because not only do I despise the Department of Corrections officials, but I despise the lawyers that deny people the civil rights help that they need. I despise lawyers and advocates for depriving these prisoners of getting help unless they're wealthy prisoners. Now, this one has not only lost his arm for good, a damage that's going to be permanent. How does one get a life without parole, be in a prison for the rest of his life with one arm to defend himself? It doesn't make sense. These are some of the injustices that I find overwhelmingly disgusting, because there's nobody out there helping these type of prisoners.
No, absolutely. These people get this fund. It goes back to what I opened up with, is that these organizations and these advocates out here getting all this funding and doing absolutely nothing with it.
Exactly.
And, you know, the problem is that the prison system, it's a lucrative business now. It's not to send somebody away to get them out of society. It's a business. It is. We are lucrative. We are worth, in California, we're worth almost $100,000 a year. And it takes nowhere near that to house an inmate. So, and we've discussed this in prior weeks.
I believe in Massachusetts it's $75,000 a year
That's
to house a prisoner. But you know what? Prisoner Legal Services and American Civil Liberties Union, those two law firms are so consistently denying people help. I remember when we had to go out, the New Vision organization had to go out to Pennsylvania because three prisoners were being kept in the hole, and they were being abused severely. Joe Kappa, Joe Hoquin, and Clifford Finney all died in a matter of 3 months when I was writing to some of those politicians, and I was calling ACLU in Pennsylvania, begging them to meet with these prisoners, telling them what was going on. We consistently hear them say they don't have the manpower, they don't have the funding, but yet they have all over their website, they have that this is the thing that they do. If you can't do it, if you don't have the manpower or the funds, don't put it on your website or temporarily suspend all further referrals. They don't do this.
Well, this goes back to
a prisoner in 2011 attempted suicide. They try to force him to double cell. If this was late at night, it was in the video. They try to force him to double cell. As a result, they beat him up. Four guards beat this prisoner up severely. The prisoner tried to get help from Prisoner Legal Services and asking them to view the video. Prisoner Legal Services never viewed it. The prison officials got away with it. These are the kind of things that really upset. We can't be that disgusted with the DOC, the prison officials, when we have people on the outside getting all this money, claiming to do all this to help with the civil rights violations and doing absolutely nothing.
Well, and this goes back to the funding that people are giving these organizations. They're doing absolutely nothing with it. And for the people that are trying, like, do you know how hard it is to get a grant for my organization? Nobody's willing to give me money because I'm not in their pocket. They're not willing to – there's no kickback. There's no – the last thing they want to do is give a former inmate with an organization any funding to make changes. And that's the problem with it, is that they're in the pockets as well. And how they treat us in there is inhumane, for one. But do you know that with a family of three, I can survive? We can survive off $40,000. I think $37,000. Tell me how you do. How each inmate is worth so much money. Where are they? Where are they padding these numbers at? I mean, everything's being padded. It's taking this much or this much, and we're doing all the work in the prisons. We're making all the lunches. We're making all the food. And then they get their food donated and everything else. And yet, it's still the price of the inmate is going up every year.
I understand.
The COs are getting paid more money.
I understand the COs and the guards are the ones that eat the good food too. There was a girl from California right this morning. Told me her husband, he's in Massachusetts, she's in California. Her husband called her. He was sick. He ate some bad food that they gave him while in the cell. This is a prisoner that's in 22 hours a day. She said that her husband got sick off some bad food they served him. The guards are getting the employees get all the good stuff, and people on the outside are complaining because they're feeling the prisoners are being treated with all this good stuff, good food, good benefits, and everything else. If they only had a clue what was going on behind the wall.
No, my wife got in an argument about a year ago with one of her coworkers, and her husband's a CO. And she came to work one day saying, yeah, they're eating steak in prison. And my wife was like, they're not eating steak in prison. And she believed everything her husband was coming back and saying that we eat steak in prison. Let me tell you something. We haven't had real meat in prison since 2002 when they took in California, since they made everything soy. That's all we're getting. They're under a 1,500. The calorie, they do everything by calories in prison. And if you don't eat it, you don't get the calories. It's a 2,200 calories a day limit. That's what they're required to feed us. Do you know let me tell you something. In food out here, 2,200 calories, I eat that before lunch. And you're telling me grown men with health issues that need proper food, and if you try to get on a medical diet, forget about it. You know, that's just not going to happen. Jeff, you know about this, right? You want to shine some light?
Yeah, I would say, again, like I mentioned last time, I mean, a lot of times the food would be fully cooked. Other times it would be burned. I never – there's steak in prison, I wish. The same items would be on the food menu 2 and 3 times a week before making its final appearance on Sunday. They would put it in some soup. You know, they call it a soup, but it's just a bunch of all the leftovers with a gallon of water dumped on top of it. I mean, you know, if you were responsible on the serving line to serve out the soup, you know, you would get very little business that night. So, the food is bad. I mean, you know, just to chime in terms of meat, I remember, your hamburgers were just soy. It wasn't chopped meat. At all, and a lot of things are just generic. I mean, it's not real eggs. It's powdered. The meat is probably like the turkey is not real. It's processed and everything. You know, with breading on it as well. So no, it is hard. My point is that it is hard to get healthy. It's hard to eat healthy in prison, and you know the food is definitely substandard. And to me that's unacceptable. I mean, you know, food quality should not be, you know, part of the punishment.
So let me give you guys, for anyone listening going, what the hell are they complaining about food for? I'm going to tell you the history of why they do what they do. Back in the 60s, there used to be a requirement to be a CO. You had to be a certain height requirement, weight requirement, and you had to be in physical shape. You couldn't be fat, you couldn't be too skinny, and you couldn't be too small. And so the inmates were getting bigger than the guards that were coming in, so they took our weights from us. Nobody got killed with the weights. That's not why they took it. They took it because we were getting too big. They started underfeeding us and malnourishing us because they don't want us in proper shape. They don't want us to overtake them. That's their whole fear. That's their whole method behind this. And so what they do is they malnourish us, and they give us this food. That's why, I mean, think about it. $1 a day for each inmate. How many people out here can survive on $1 a day for food? What kind of food do you think you're going to get for $1 a day? So that's just something to think about out there, that for your loved ones in prison. And do you think that because they're asking for a food package, that they're selling it for drugs, or they're sitting there giving it away or anything? It's very important that our loved ones take care of us behind those walls, because, you know, that sausage, that bag of beans, that extra, you know, even those Twinkies. My wife used to buy me a box of Twinkies, or several boxes of Twinkies in a package, and that was like my thing. I'd take out down a whole box of Twinkies, but that box of Twinkies was so important and special to me.
Lauren, I'm sorry. Huh. I just wanted to let you know that Attorney Descovy has got to leave in a few minutes, and I don't know if you want to say a few words to him before he leaves.
Absolutely. Hey, Jeff, man, I love what you're doing. Is there and I appreciate just having this conversation, you know, former inmate to former inmate, and your insight and what you're doing. Can you drop your information so people could contact you and put a little bit out there for, you know, others?
Yeah, definitely. Sure. So people can reach me through my website, www.descovic.org. That's D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C. And there's a web form there, so people can email me through that. I'm on social media as well, Facebook, Instagram, LinkedIn. Again, my name's Jeffrey Descovic, D-E-S-K-O-V-I-C. All of those applications have a messaging function with them, and I do answer my messages. So it was great to come on the show unexpectedly today and share information, and I'm certainly open to making future appearances as well. And, you know, I do appreciate you having a show and having me on. It's very important that everybody, you know, play the role, do whatever they can that's within their ability. And, you know, you're doing that with the show. So I do want to admire that and just shout you out, salute you for that, and Leona as well.
Jeffrey, so. we will be interviewing Jeffrey on Wednesday, the 9th, and that will be from 1 to 2. And Jeffrey will have his partner on, Leslie Robinson. The two of them have started a foundation. And Jeffrey, if you want to say that real quick, and we will be having him on Wednesday from 1 o'clock until 2 p.m. on the 9th at 3:30, I'm sorry, at 1 p.m. Eastern time.
Yes, yeah. So Leslie and I we co-own a game called Recharge Beyond the Bars Reentry Game, and it does facilitate formerly incarcerated people with reconnecting with their friends and family through icebreaker questions. Yeah, so you know, we'll be talking some about that and other, you know, prison reform / prisoner reentry issues on that interview. And yeah, and you know, there is my you know, foundation, the Jeffrey Descovic Foundation for Justice, which, you know, we free innocent people and we pursue the policy changes. So, you know, that's different from Recharge, but I am in common with both of those. And, you know, they harmonize because, you know, the game facilitates reentry. And obviously when someone is released from prison, they need to reenter society. And the reentry issues of someone who's been released when they've been exonerated, there's a lot of overlap even with people who are reentering society through parole. You know, so that's my way of trying to give back and you know, assist that population as well. So I'm looking forward to that interview on Wednesday as well.
Nice. And hey, brother, I love what you're doing, and you have anything for my organization that we could offer to help. You have complete alliance with Legacy Programs. So
thank you very much.
Keep doing what you're doing.
I will.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
All right, brother. Hey, keep doing what you're doing, man. Keep making that difference.
Thanks, you too.
Love you.
Absolutely.
All right. So we have about 5 minutes left. If anybody else wants to comment or got any questions, feel free to ask. Feel free to speak.
Actually, Lawrence, we have 15 minutes left. 3:30 to 5.
Oh, okay. Sorry. 15 minutes. anybody got any comments or questions? Okay.
I just want to say, Lawrence, since you've been out, you've done an excellent job in everything that you've been doing. You came out, just like with Jeffrey, you came out with a lot of baggage that occurred more so inside than outside, I think. but you picked right up and you got right out there and you started doing all this good work. And I know advocates that have been out there for years and years that haven't done half as much as you have done in the short time you've been out. I want to thank your brother as well for coming on, because he's been very supportive of you, and also Christine. So I'm really happy to have gotten to know them, even though I haven't met them personally. They've been on every show that you have had on, and that's family.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And that's just the thing, is that, you know, to help me sleep at night is to be able to make a difference and to have that purpose and cause. And I believe it's God-driven. And, you know, he puts his vision and this voice to it and says, go for it. And I think that it's important for us to speak out. I think as a formerly incarcerated, I come across many people that don't want others to know that they were incarcerated. But yet it comes out in their behavior, in their mannerisms, in their speech. And it's like an illusion that they're hiding. And I just want to, for anyone listening out there that is formerly incarcerated, don't be ashamed of who you are and where you're at. It is what it is. And, you know, I use that hurt and that pain, and I turn it into something beautiful with a purpose. And I think that's what keeps me going. As far as, you know, what I've done, the only reason I've been able to do what I do is because of the people around me and the support I have. If I were to do it by myself, sure, I could do it, but not at this pace. And so just a huge shout out to all the people that have been behind me, and especially my family. You know, my wife allows me to do this stuff. You know, that's how I feel, because family is most important. And if your family is not behind what you're doing, you're doomed for failure. And so it's important that we have these resources out here and these connections and this network, because in the end of the day, when you're sitting by yourself and you're alone with your demons, it's important to be at peace with that and to what you're doing. So, I mean, I just, like I say, my pastor and his wife, if they didn't take me in, I don't think I would have the tools that I have today and the drive that I'm able to go. We're Legacy Programs is in the midst of getting a deal with the prison, with the California State Prison, to go in and bring my program in there. So I'm hoping that makes a difference. And I just encourage for everyone out there to just let your voice be heard and don't be ashamed of it. And just it is what it is, you know, speak your truth and let that be known. And Leona, like you've let me on your show my first month out, and I've been on it ever since. And I think where I'm at today, I wouldn't be where I'm at if it wasn't for you and for you allowing me this an hour and a half every single Sunday. So I just want to thank you.
I as I said, as I told the same thing with Jeffrey, what you guys are doing is not from me or anyone else human in this world. It is from God himself, because you're bringing awareness. You're talking about issues that if anybody godly in this country hears it, would be trying to do something to help these prisoners, to help you, to fund you, to join you, or whatever. So it's almost like we're finding out just who really is sincerely godly and Christian-like, and we're finding out who just doesn't care at all. We have people that could do a lot more than they're doing. And as they say, Prison Legal Services, ACLU, a lot of these lawyers, law firms, while they're going to these coalitions that I should be attending because of the seriousness of our loved ones being inside, these people are going to these coalitions because they're getting paid by the hour. So they prefer to be in the coalitions talking rather than being able to help these prisoners who are saying that every time they call, they're getting a receptionist. They're not getting any from the lawyers. But this is...
Yeah.
Not of me. This is of God himself.
No, I agree. And that's the thing with Legacy Programs, Education Reentry, is that, you know, I vow to make a difference. I'm just waiting for that opportunity to be able to do more than what I do. And until then, you know, I encourage anybody and everybody, like I say, to always know who your advocate is. You know, if you can't, if you're giving money to a foundation and you can't talk to the founder, or the person that created it, something's wrong with that. And my number is I talk to everybody. In fact, I even do my own checklist for every single person enrolled in my program, because I want to know who's in my program. And yeah, I could sit there and push it off to somebody else, but that's how important this is to me, is that I want to know who I'm helping. I want to know the families of who I'm helping. And that's why I think I'm so successful in what I do, is because I'm personally invested. And if you're donating money out there to some cause and you can't get a hold of a person for, you know, ask them simply, what are you doing with this money? Forget a mission statement. Mission statement's outdated. If you can't talk directly to that person, something is horribly wrong. Get in touch with the people that are actually making the difference. And like I say, you know, I vow to sit there and make a difference. I'm just waiting for my chance to actually make a move. And until then, I'm just setting myself up for when that time comes, I'm going to be ready. So anybody that wants to jump on board with Legacy Programs, let's partner up. Let's do something. There's plenty of room for everybody. And that's just my take. And I think that's one of the things of why it's successful, is because I don't isolate nobody. Everybody serves a purpose. And I'm for that purpose. I'm for building people up, not tearing people down. So that's
let's hear from your brother and your sister-in-law. They've been listening in every week. Let's hear what they have to say about all of this.
Sure.
Yeah, and you know what? Also, I just want to put in there that Legacy Program is also for every state prison. We're not limiting anybody out. We're trying to be global. So I sure was a question for that recently. So I just wanted to put that out there, that we're trying to transition everybody.
Compiled or composed like a brochure for your organization, Lawrence?
Yes.
Oh, you have? Okay.
Set up. He is the boss, so I have to have him look over it, and we should be sending that out next week.
Great. If you want, you can, I don't know if you have it on your website, the brochure or a mission statement or whatever, but if you want, you can actually, I can have our man put it on our website too, if you'd like.
That would be great. Yeah, because I'm putting it up on our website as soon as everything's okay with the boss over here. And and then I can send it to you, Leona, anytime.
Okay.
And that's another thing, like, you know, what New Vision Organization is doing is on the same page as I am. I mean, we're all in this fight together, so. You know, I encourage everybody to look into the New Vision Organization, not located in San Francisco, by the way, the one in Massachusetts. So, and to sit there and, you know, donations, to sit there and be part of the organization. I've been gladly accepted into that fold. And as an advocate and as a motivational speaker, you know, I take a lot of pride in being part of something so special. So.
Actually, New Vision Organization was founded in 2004, and at the time we were advocating for the incarcerated men, women, and youth across the country. We were working with those on death row, our lifers, life without parole. We were working with those soon to be released, men, women, and youth. We used to, at the time, we were actually doing a lot of extensive research and finding supportive aftercare resources. We would help them with their resumes. We would write letters on their behalf so they could take them to the thrift shops and get free clothing so that they could be presentable when they went job hunting. We also networked with the courts for those who were doing community services. We got volunteers in that way. We helped with we had a contact person at a lot of the community colleges so that these prisoners coming out at the time could go for higher education. And we had a contact person in housing. We did transitional housing. What happened is I stepped down in 2014, and three of my volunteers that took over, they brought in somebody from Pennsylvania who messed up. And when that person messed up, they couldn't resolve it, and they never let me know what was going on. So rather than to let me know so I could get it straightened out, they registered New Vision Organization out in California under a different tax exempt. When I found out, I contacted the state of Massachusetts to get it up and running again. But now our focus is on lifers, first-time offenders serving life and life without in Massachusetts only. But the thing is, we still have volunteers from all over the country working with us. And Lawrence, is, as he mentioned, is a motivational speaker in the organization as well. So I am proud to have him working with us, and I'm proud to see that he's got his own foundation and that his brother and his sister-in-law are part of it. And as we always say when we do the radio show, we are looking for people who are listening to this radio show and every other interview and shows that we've had to get involved, make some calls, call into the studio when these talks are going on. We want to hear from you. We want your opinion. We want your feedback. And we want your help, because numbers, success is in numbers. We can't just be talking about the problems and doing absolutely nothing. And that's why we need the audience that is listening in to call in sometimes and talk. And Lawrence, yeah. This is your show. I just had to get it out there, because people listen,
no,
but a lot of them don't act.
No, I agree. And that's the thing, is the time is now. The prison reform is so huge in this battle, and we need, like you say, we need the numbers. We're not trying to turn people away. This isn't about us. This is about our cause and our purpose, and that is to cure a broken system as best we can. And you know, we're gonna mess up their count. We're gonna continue to keep that bunk empty as much as we can, by encouraging the younger generation to see that we're embracing even felons, and we're embracing those that said that we weren't deemed to come back to society. And by showing acceptance of somebody that's formerly incarcerated, you give a good example to your child, to your neighbor's child, and to the community around you that there's still hope, and that nobody gives up on each other, because it truly takes a village to raise a child. And so that is one of our goals of why we do what we do, is promoting the younger generation, the future leaders. So, and if anybody wants to contact, you can look us up on legacyprograms.net. As Christine said, that we're trying to go global. We help out anybody we can. We offer mentor programs, parole packets. We offer curriculum, correspondence curriculum. We will do this. We will do everything we can for our lost ones. And for the, you know, for anybody that wants to jump on board, feel free. You know, just ask what can you do. And you could also find me on Facebook, Legacy Programs. I'm under Sparky Lee, and we're part of Each One Teach One, our Legacy Each One Teach One, and we're involved in all kinds of things out here. So ask questions, get the conversation started, and if anyone wants to, you could hit me up on my Gmail, which is Lawrence Drink. D as in David, R-E-N-K, at gmail.com.
We have a minute and a half left.
And I just want to thank everybody that's part of this vision of mine, and everyone that's been on the journey since day one, and for even the people that have been on the journey in the middle of it and towards the end. I couldn't have done it without you, and I'm grateful for everyone that listens. And grateful for everyone that comments and asks questions. And I want to give a special shout out to Jeffrey. Man, you are an inspiration, and I could only hope in the time that this is to be completed that I achieve the greatness that you have. So I'm just proud to see one of our lost ones find themselves and to help other people and to be in the right fight. So, and thank you, Leona.
Thank you. We are now going to be shutting down, and I thank everyone for coming on and listening to Lawrence Drank, host, and his guest. We will see everyone or speak with everyone or hear everyone next Sunday, 3:30 p.m. Eastern Time, to once again listen to Lawrence and his guest. Thank you so much.
Thank
Anytime.
You, everybody.
Thank you. Bye, brother.
Bye.